Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. All this week on the show, it's the Soundcheck Writers Club. Membership is free. There are no monthly dues. All you have to do is listen. Listen and learn. Like when Jonathan Lethem explains what it was like to profile James Brown for Rolling Stone.
I lived with the band in a Radisson, in a hotel. For 4 days and went every day with them to either play or not play. They spent a lot of time not playing. And I basically fell into the orbit of James Brown for a few days there. And it really is an orbit around a kind of bizarre planet. He's not like other people.
Okay, so maybe you already knew that James Brown wasn't like other people. But coming up later, Jonathan Lethem, the author of Fortress of Solitude, Motherless Brooklyn, and Chronic City, talks about rock criticism, the band The Go-Betweens, plagiarism, and much more. And we'll hear some bookish songs from Patti Smith and Martha Redbone. But first, Khalid Hosseini is best known as the author of The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns, both best-selling novels set in Afghanistan. His latest book is called And the Mountains Echoed. It begins in Afghanistan, but follows its characters, Abdullah and his baby sister, Pari, through a web of stories that reaches as far as California, France, and the Greek islands. We asked Khalid Hosseini to bring in some of his favorite songs for one of our Pick 3 segments, and to no one's surprise, the songs he picked came from Afghanistan. So I asked him if these were things he listened to growing up.
Oh, it's the soundtrack of my childhood. And it's in many ways a soundtrack of my adulthood. The songs that I picked, particularly the first two songs by the singer named Ahmad Zahir, are songs that I listened to when I was a kid growing up in Kabul. They're songs that I listened to when I was a teen in France, when I was an adolescent in the United States, when I grew up in the U.S. And they're songs that I listen to now with my brothers at parties, and we'll sit at a table with a bottle of single malt, and we'll play these old songs. The lyrics, most of us know the lyrics, and we'll just listen to these songs and reminisce.
So his name is Ahmad Zahir.
Yes.
How big was this guy in Afghanistan?
Oh, I picked him because I feel like to speak about Afghan music, modern Afghan music, without mentioning Ahmad Zahir would be like to speak about rock and roll without mentioning Elvis or the Beatles. Mm-hmm. It's almost impossible to overstate the influence that he's had in Afghanistan. He was only really on the popular scene for about 10 years. But what Ahmad Zahir did in the 70s in Afghanistan is akin to what Bob Dylan did when he took up the electric guitar. Up to that point, Afghan music was essentially played with very traditional instruments, the harmonium, a tabla, which is the percussions, mm-hmm. and possibly a string instrument like the rubab or maybe a sitar. What Ahmad Zahir did was he essentially just modernized the whole music scene. He brought in drums, he brought in trumpets, gasp, electric guitars.
Right.
And he brought this very kind of a westernized kind of influence while at the same time, singing very traditional songs, sometimes singing songs that the lyrics were Sufi poems, from Rumi. And so he was a very strange and exciting and very, very compelling kind of hybrid.
And it sounds like maybe in contrast to Elvis and Dylan, someone whose appeal went across generations.
Oh, he's probably bigger now than he was then. In fact, there are entire classes of musicians in Afghanistan who are making a very good living and have become very popular themselves for the sole reason that they sound just like Ahmad Zahir, and who is the best mimic of Ahmad Zahir. He is pound for pound as big as Elvis, I think.
Mean that literally. He was a big guy.
He became a big guy toward the end. And of course, the fact that he died young at 33 and died tragically, and that he was what many people say he was martyred, which is the word they like to use, adds a great deal to his mystique and to his mythical stance.
I want to come back to that in a moment, but let's give folks a chance to hear what we're talking about. Ahmad Zaher is the Afghani singer. Tughule Nazhama?
Tughule Nazhama, which means you are everybody's flower.
This is music picked for us by the author Khalid Hosseini. That is music from the great Afghan singer Ahmad Zaher, chosen for us by Khalid Hosseini, the author of The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Sons. His new book is called And the Mountains Echoed. There is a line in your book that really struck me, and I'm not going to get it word for word, but to the effect that if culture is a house, language is the key to the front door.
Right.
Language is important in Afghanistan. This is something you've talked about in several sections of your books, is the different ethnic groups and stuff. What is the language that Ahmad Zaher is singing in?
Well, he's singing in Dari, which is the sort of the national language of Afghanistan, although there, you know, Pashto is also widely spoken in Afghanistan, particularly in the south and in the east. And there are a number of other dialects as well. But the official language was Dari. So he's singing in Dari, which is sort of a very, very close to Farsi. It's essentially the same language as Farsi or Persian.
Mm-hmm. So would the people in the small towns, the people that we meet early on in this book, for example, would they have understood the texts in Dari?
Yes, they would have. Certainly, they would have understood it. And he also, by the way, sang in Pashto, and he sang in Urdu. He sang sort of the Bollywood classics and so on. So he sang in different languages, but most of his music was in Dari.
Right. Now, when you are writing, do you have music on? Can you listen and write at the same time?
I can't. I mean, it needs to be. I need to have no stimulation at all. I'm an easily distracted person, so I don't listen to music when I'm actually writing. I also shut down the windows, so I don't want to have a view either. My big bane is the internet, and I have to find some way of dealing with that. But but if I listen to Ahmad Zaher, I won't get anything done. Because you just played that song, and I might as well be 9 years old again and be living in Kabul. I mean, it's just such a, it just transports me completely to that time and place.
Is that why he's still, all these years after his death, still so popular? Because it does transport people back to a different Afghanistan?
He is sort of the voice of those final few golden years in Afghanistan where everybody was happy, where there was peace before the country unraveled. And he died in 1979. On the mysterious circumstances. Most people believe he was murdered.
Mm-hmm. Officially a car crash.
Well, officially a car crash, but many people believe it was a staged car crash. He was murdered first, and then the car crash was staged. Nobody really knows what happens. The people who know the truth will probably take the secret with themselves to the grave. But he died in 1979, which is incidentally the year that the Soviets invaded Afghanistan and everything fell apart. So it's almost like that era died with him.
Right. Now, is that incidental, or do the theories of him being murdered have something to do with the communists?
Well, you know, his politics were known to be sort of anti-Marxist, and so he was an outspoken guy. He was 33 years old. He was a young man. He liked to drink. He was a little reckless, you know, and probably ruffled the wrong feathers.
Mm. We're speaking with Khalid Hosseini, the author of the new book And the Mountains Echoed. There is something of there's not a lot of actual music. You don't mention Ahmad Zaher in the book.
Not in this
not
book.
By name.
No, in The Kite Runner.
In The Kite Runner. But music does kind of make a couple of appearances, especially jazz, as a kind of signifier of a character's aspirations to be not in Afghanistan, to be not Afghani, but to be Western.
Right. Look, I grew up at a time in Afghanistan where there was quite a lot of interest in the country from both the Soviet Union and also the West, including the U.S., France, England, and so on, because it was still the Cold War, remember? And so each side was trying to gain the favors of Afghanistan. It was this kind of a great push and pull. And Afghanistan benefited from that in many ways, in that, you know, schools and buildings and hydroelectric plants and so on was built in Afghanistan, one by the Soviets, and the Germans would build a school and so on. And the other thing that happened was that there was an influx of Western culture into especially Kabul, especially into a certain crust of Kabul society, which tended to be more liberal, less religious, more westernized, liked to drink, and then liked to listen to music from the West. And so I heard Tom Jones, for instance, for the first time at a party in Kabul. Is the first time I ever heard the Beatles, and you know, it's the first time I ever heard jazz, which sounded just a complete mess to my ears back then. So this woman, this character Nila, who's a poet in the Mountain Echoes, she's a big fan of jazz, and she listens to it in Kabul, and you know.
And she is the one who eventually takes the girl she's adopted and moves to the West.
She moves to France, where she's half French, and she moves back to France, where she feels much more, you know, at home in her bohemian elements.
We're speaking with Khaled Hosseini. His new book is called And the Mountains Echoed. Joining us for a pick three here today, the first two songs of which come from this Afghani singer, Ahmed Zahir. In Egypt, they had Umm Kulthum. When she died, they shut the country down for 3 days for her funeral. In Jamaica, something similar happened when Bob Marley died. When Zahir died in Afghanistan, what was the reaction?
Oh, national mourning on a mass scale. I mean, people poured into the streets. It was covered by the television virtually around the clock. It was a national tragedy. You know,
Where were you? Where were you living?
I was in France, and I have never shed a tear for the passing of a celebrity, even if it was somebody that I really admired. But I will say to you that when I heard Ahmed Zahir died, I wept. I felt the end of an era. I felt a part of my childhood had died, and I was angry. I was deeply angry with whoever had done this. I was deeply angry with the country as a whole for. It doesn't make any sense, but I was just so sick of the violence, and I was just, it was such a waste. And I went to Kabul again in 2003 for the first time in 27 years. And one of the things I promised myself I would do is go and visit Ahmed Zahir's grave. And I'll tell you, I went there, it was a travesty. It was, here's a legend buried, and there's sort of a monument where he's buried. But it's been destroyed. The Taliban shot bullets into it because they deplored music, particularly popular music. And so the stories had it that they had come to his gravesite and just shot at his grave in the Kite Runner essay, you know, as if dying once wasn't enough. You know, he had to die again. So I think I may have shed a tear for a second time for Ahmed Zahir there. I'm glad to hear, though, that that they've rebuilt the monument and that it's now a place where people come and pay proper respects.
So he's still this enormous figure in Afghani culture. What is this second song that we're going to hear? I'll defer to you for the pronunciation.
It's called Zindagi Chist, which means what is life? And it's a song about how difficult life is, and it's full of sorrow and hardships. And that's the way life is. We might as well enjoy it. We might as well make the best of it. And I picked this song because it's actually recorded live. And he was at his most electric when he would sing in people's homes or at private parties. And so this is a live recording.
Chosen for us by author Khaled Hosseini. This is music from Ahmed Zahir.
Zindagi chis,
Khaled Hosseini, that's a much more traditional sound than the other Ahmad Zahir tune you played for us.
Right, and he was an accomplished accordion player and a harmonium player. And when he was at his most electric, really, when he played live. And in Afghanistan, it was very common to have even the most famous singers, they would just go to a party and would be invited and they would sing and people would come and listen to them speak, listen to them sing. And so when he sang at parties in people's homes, then it was kind of just more down to basics. It was a harmonium, maybe an accordion, and a tabla player, and then people would clap along, and he would sing until 4 or 5 in the morning.
It occurs to me, I said a few moments ago, that your latest novel, And the Mountains Echoed, doesn't have a lot of music in it. But in fact, the whole novel is sort of constructed like a piece of music. It begins with this fable, which kind of gives us a theme.
Like an intro.
Yeah. And then that theme is then varied and developed and, you know, I mean, all the things you get in the classical sonata allegro form, you know, the theme, the development, the recapitulation, all these things coming together. I mean, was it a tale that grew in the telling or did you have that structure in mind?
It sort of grew out of this small seed and it just kept snowballing and it just kept snowballing and it kept reaching outward and kept spreading outward, kind of like a... you drop a little drop of ink on something and it just kind of spreads outwards. And that's sort of the way it started. I mean, I thought it was going to be sort of this linear novel when I began the book. And then I became so interested in all these other characters and voices that I saw that the only way to tell this story was kind of shape it like a tree. You know, there's this trunk, which is this emotional story between a brother who loses his sister and never really fully recovers from it. And then the all these branches that sprout out from that main story.
Mm-hmm. There's also a remarkable sentence at the end of one of the chapters where there are literal echoes. There's the always, always, and the mountain that falls and falls. I mean, literal repetition of words.
Right.
How were you consciously, you know, kind of playing with the title, that fragment of the William Blake poem?
Yes, and there's also, you know, where it's... We're on a music show, and there's a kind of a musicality to writing sentences. I mean, fiction, you write, you begin to know your own voice in your head. And as you write, and over the years, you develop a cadence, a certain rhythm, a certain tempo, and a sort of your own musical voice inside your head. So those sentences just kind of pour out of you. And it's like the mountains don't just fall away, they fall and fall away. And there's like a musicality to it that I just love, and you know, that's sort of how the way it happens.
The book is And the Mountains Echoed. It is Khaled Hosseini's first new novel in 6 years after A Thousand Splendid Suns, and before that, of course, The Kite Runner. And he's sharing some favorite music with us on Soundcheck today. All right, so we've heard two from Ahmad Zahir, who is so big that there are now Ahmed impersonators, the way there are Elvis impersonators here in the States, right?
Except they're very well accomplished and beloved for their own merits.
Some Elvis impersonators are pretty damn good.
They're not jumping out of airplanes.
But let's move on to another artist that you've been listening to lately, Ustad Mahwash.
Yeah, it's just somebody I've been listening to my whole life. And Ustad Mahwash's roots go back to the same era as Ahmad Zahir. Thankfully, she's still around.
Uh-huh.
She's one of the most well-respected female singers in Afghanistan, is the only female singer that has been given the title of Ustad, which means master. Wonderful singer, an iconic voice in Afghanistan. Cut her teeth singing a lot of ghazals, or classic poems.
Mm-hmm.
And this particular song that I've picked is one of her most famous compositions and one of the most famous songs. And the lyrics of the song are a very famous poem by Rumi called, I think in English it's called Song of the Reed. But it's one of these Sufi-themed poems about the relationship between man and divinity.
Mm-hmm.
And she paid me the great honor of actually singing this song at my wedding in 1993. So this song has very, very special meaning to me.
What's it called, the title?
The it Well, the title is called Bishnawaz Nai, which means listen to the reed, the Nai flute.
This is Ustad Mahwash, chosen for us by Khaled Hosseini.
Bishnawaz Nai, chun hikayat me.
That is some music, again, chosen for us by the author Khaled Hosseini, by Ustad Mahwash, Afghani singer Khaled. She's now based here in the States.
Yeah, she lives here in the States.
And if you listen carefully, you can hear the nai, the or
yes.
nay, depending on how you pronounce it,
yes.
the cane flute, which is
yes.
associated with Sufi
And then the basis of this poem is that the plight of the nai flute, which has been ripped from the reed bed, and is now singing this mournful, longing song, is akin to what's happened to mankind, who's been ripped from his essence, from his divinity, and is forever lost, and is forever mourning to return to his back home, back to where he belongs with God.
Now, in a funny way, you've almost just perfectly described the story of And the Mountains Echoed, is Abdullah and Pari separated when he's 10 and she's 3, brother and sister,
right.
and each feeling the absence of the other, even though Pari, as she grows up, doesn't know why she's feeling this absence.
Yes, and that's beautifully said, actually. And the Mountains is really a story about separation, and it's about having lost something vital, and you're being aware that there is an absence in your life, and you have this, and all of us have in our life lost something, and the sort of this infantile, almost infantile instinct, desire to be reunited, either in a real way or in a metaphorical way. And that really kind of ties into the song as well.
We've been speaking with the author Khaled Hosseini, who wrote the best-selling novels The Kite Runner and A Thousand Splendid Suns. His new book is called And the Mountains Echoed. He's been sharing a pick three with us on Soundcheck today. Khaled, this has been a lot of fun. Thank you so much.
I loved it. Thank you for giving me a chance to share this music with the audience.
This is Soundcheck.
چشم سیاه ساقه مادر نبیند آقه چشم سیاه ساقه مادر نبیند آقه مادر بیند نبیند بای بای عاشق نبیند آقه مادر بیند نبیند بای بای.
That's a little more from the late Afghani musician Ahmad Zahir, a big favorite of our guest, the novelist Khaled Hosseini. Later in the show, we'll hear from another music-obsessed novelist, Jonathan Lethem, whose books include Motherless Brooklyn and The Fortress of Solitude. But our Writers' Club series continues in a moment with a Russian literary nod from Patti Smith. Plus, Martha Redbone, known for her interpretations of Native American culture, takes on the English poet William Blake. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. More now in the Soundcheck Writers Club, our week-long look at authors and music. Singer Patti Smith won the National Book Award in 2010 for her memoir, Just Kids, about her friendship with the artist Robert Mapplethorpe. 2 years later, she released her album, Banga, and joined me in the Soundcheck studio to share some tracks from it. We got to talking about Banga's title track, which takes its name from a character in the Mikhail Bulgakov novel, The Master and Margarita.
Yes, it's the dog in Master and Margarita. It was Pontius Pilate's dog. And I was very taken with this dog, who is a minor character in Bulgakov's masterpiece, but such an example of love and loyalty that I wanted to write a song for Banga. And the song itself evokes my feeling about my band, the people, when we perform. It's, again, it's just a reverent little song. I even wrote the music. It's a very simple song, but it's our little anthem.
Mm-hmm. For folks who haven't read the Master and Margarita, Banga, Pontius Pilate is, he's sort of spending eternity, it seems, waiting to be pardoned for the crime of having...
Well, he just wants to talk to Jesus Christ. I don't know if he expects to be pardoned, but he wants to perhaps apologize, mm-hmm. but also continue their very interesting conversation. I think after he regretted putting him to death, but also realized that he was talking to a person of such intelligence and he was surrounded with such stupidity mm-hmm. that he missed him. But he was made to wait for 2,000 years, and Banga, his dog, waited patiently by his side. And I just thought that was beautiful.
Right. And here's Lenny and JD, and these guys have been at your side.
Oh, Lenny's been with me for 40-some years. JD, close to that. JD's been my only drummer since 1975. And Tony has been my bass player and collaborator since 1995. So, you know, we're a true band.
Lyle, the rest in the heart of the dog. Don't sell all your eggs on the back of a frog. You can lick it twice, but it won't lick you. And salivate with salvation's long, so long, so.
That's Banga, the title track from Patti Smith's most recent album. As we heard Patti explaining, it was inspired by Banga, the loyal dog, in Mikhail Bulgakov's novel The Master and Margarita, and by Patti's equally loyal band. You can hear the full interview with Patti Smith at soundcheck.org. It's Writers' Week, all this week, on Soundcheck. Now, we've heard a lot of different kinds of musical mashups and genre fusions here in the Soundcheck studio, but in 2012, the singer-songwriter Martha Redbone did something that we hadn't heard before. She combined the sounds of Americana from her Kentucky roots with the poetry of England's William Blake.
How sweet I roamed from field to field and tasted all the summer's pride till I, the prince of love, beheld who in the sunny beams did fly. He shoot me lilies for my head and blushing roses for my brow. He led me through his garden fair, where all his golden pleasures grow. With sweet May dews my wings were wet, and feet aspired my vocal rage. He caught me in his silken net and shut me in his golden cage. He loves to sit and hear me sing, then laughing sports and plays with me, then stretches out my golden wing and mocks my loss of liberty. With sweet May dews my wings were wet, and feet inspired my vocal rage. He caught me in his silken net and shut me in his golden cage. He loves to sit and hear me sing, mocks my loss of liberty.
The Martha Redbone Roots Project with How Sweet I Roamed. You can listen to the full session on demand on our website, soundcheck.org. Up next on this installment of Soundcheck's week-long Writers Club series, a novelist and serious music fan, Jonathan Lethem. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It's Writers Club week on Soundcheck, and we turn now to the novelist Jonathan Lethem. He's been an occasional guest on the show over the years. I live in Brooklyn. I happen to love his writing, and I know a lot of Brooklynites do as well. Books like The Fortress of Solitude, Motherless Brooklyn. But when he joined us in 2011, Jonathan had just published a book of essays called The Ecstasy of Influence, Nonfictions, Etc. It includes some of Lethem's forays into music journalism, and he told us that he had real reservations about writing about music.
You know, I came to writing fiction out of an art, fine arts training. I went to art school. I wanted to make objects. I wanted to make beautiful, you know, useless artifacts like sculptures and paintings. And when I first wanted to write, I wanted to write novels and stories, and I thought reality didn't have anything to do with it. I was never going to write nonfiction or essays or reviews. I was going to write, you know, these glamorous things like pop songs, except on the page, right? And I've always, of course, absorbed also this residual impression from, you know, the kind of dancing about architecture problem, that there was something inane and impossible about trying to reproduce what you loved about music on the page. It was
the quote is, writing about music is like dancing about architecture.
Yes.
In the book, you attribute that quote to Frank Zappa.
I've heard it attributed to a number of people. It's one of those that floats around.
I had always heard it was Thelonious Monk.
Oh, but see, that's great. Yeah,
it might have even been before.
I've been collecting variations as I walk around with this book now. Well, anyway, so I did feel that, you know, there's something kind of absurd in the attempt to frame such a visceral and intimate and you know. nonverbal form in to freeze it in sentences. On the other hand, that's also a beautiful impossibility. It's a kind of marvelous, you know, abyss to throw your language into. I'm going to chase music and somehow catch it. So when I began slowly to defy my own weird edict against nonfiction, writing about music was one of the obvious choices for me.
And as we've learned over the years, some of your favorite writers were, in fact, writers about music.
I was a Stone fan of the kind of the founding generation, Greil Marcus, Richard Meltzer, Paul Nelson,
Lester Bangs,
Paul Williams, Greg Shaw. You know what I love so much in this field, this group of writers, Chris Gow, is that they're inventing the language for something that doesn't exist. Mm-hmm. They're ratifying that pop is even worth talking or thinking about seriously by doing so. And so there's a kind of bravery or audacity or defiance that's in the language, saying, yes, I can say this. It's not disallowed. It's a real language we're inventing.
And at its best, it is a kind of secondary art. You know, there's the primary art of the original song, and at its best, music writing
The king of that is Meltzer, who wanted to make the writing as, reproduce the terms of rock and roll, the impossibility, the ephemerality, the audacity in the language that he chose.
So there's a whole collection of these music essays in the book, which is called The Ecstasy of Influence. And then, of course, there is the title essay, which was very provocative when it was first published. It was in Harper's,
right? In Harper's, yeah.
An essay on plagiarism that is itself entirely plagiarized.
Yeah, it's like sampled music. It's girl talk, basically.
Girl talk being, in this case, the one-man band that is created entirely out of
samples. Or there was another one I liked a lot called The Avalanches that worked with stitching together only samples.
And this, too, goes to the idea of the secondary art, that, you know, somebody writes or paints or composes something and someone else, you know, perhaps with the finger of thief or plagiarist pointed at them, somehow creates something different that is equally artistic.
Sure. But of course, I think one of the things I wanted to say with that essay was that this is not a clear line, a clear demarcation, that actually most art, even the art we tend to acclaim for being completely original, is recombinant. It makes things out of sources. It draws on pre-existing culture again and again and again. Mm-hmm. And that actually tracing this fact can be a nourishing way to look at art instead of kind of exalting originality and somehow casting everything that shows traces of influence or appropriation into some subcategory.
Is Bob Dylan a good example of that?
I think he's the quintessential example because, you know, we can look at his career and, you know, with a microscope, you see that every phase of his work has an enormous degree, sometimes a problematic or for some people a disturbing or even disqualifying degree of dependence on some source. And this happens again and again and again and again. But on the other hand, when you look at his work on the cumulative, with a sense for what he's actually accomplished, it defines originality. There would be no Bob Dylan without Bob Dylan. No one else could have made this material come to life and you know, his career couldn't have occurred by accident or just by remixing pre-existing stuff. So he's the ultimate symbol of the fact that sourcing and originality are actually two sides of the same coin.
And as you've written in your article built around your interview with Bob Dylan, a lot of what he has done, you know, especially in his recent albums, you know, critics have said, well, this is clearly stolen from, you know, so-and-so, the bluesman from the North Carolina Hills in the 19th. But he has made something Bob Dylan out of it.
Well, you know, something absolutely. It's a transformative act by its nature. And he's, you know, what's fascinating is that, you know, in describing his work, Dylan has no interest in this perspective at all. He does not like to talk about attributions or sources readily, nor does he profess any interest in sort of this stuff, the theory of recombinancy. You know, on the other hand, in his practice, he is the ultimate kind of trickster, appropriator, you know, remix artist. And that also, interestingly, it's reflected in one business decision he's made, which I think is just worth kind of mentioning, that when I talked to Jeff Rosen, who's kind of the maestro of Dylan's business office, he said, well, there is one interesting fact. Dylan has never refused a request for a sample.
Mm-hmm.
Anyone who comes along and says, I'd like to take this bit of your stuff for my thing, he has blanket approval for sampling.
Bob Dylan, the subject of one of Jonathan Lethem's essays collected in the book called The Ecstasy of Influence. And that essay on Bob Dylan actually mentions in particular this song with its shout-out to Alicia Keys.
Today's the day you're gonna grab my trombone blue. Well, it's hot stuff here, and it's everywhere I go. I was thinking about Alicia Keys. Couldn't keep from crying when she was born in Hell's Kitchen. I was living down the line. I'm wondering where in the world Alicia Keys could be. I've been looking for her even clear through Tennessee. Feel like my soul is beginning to expand. Look into my heart and you will sort of understand. You brought me here, now you're trying to run me away. The writing on the wall, come read it, come see what it says.
Bob Dylan from the album Modern Times, that's called Thunder on the Mountain. That's that album from about 5 years ago. Jonathan Lethem is my guest on Soundcheck. His new essay collection is The Ecstasy of Influence, Nonfictions, Etc. As with the James Brown interview that you did, this interview with Bob Dylan was done for Rolling Stone?
They were both in Rolling Stone, yeah.
How big, how formative an influence for you were these guys, Dylan and Brown?
Well, pretty baseline. I mean, Dylan in particular was in my house before. He was part of the language of my childhood because my parents had the albums and my mother had even kind of briefly hung out with Dylan in the folk scene in the very early 60s. She was a barefoot folky girl,
mm-hmm.
on McDougal Street. So it was part of the texture of, I guess I'd call it, household culture. And that meant, of course, I had to contend with it as, you know, my parents' legacy and thrust it away at one point. My embrace of punk rock in the 70s, when it came along, it was sort of my chance to have a music that was defiantly my own.
Mm-hmm.
And so for a little while, I might have kind of defined myself precisely against Dylan. But in fact, he was so deep in my DNA by then that I was always destined to come back to it. And I did with a vengeance. And it's been an obsession for me. So it's very hard to see, you know, with something that organic, it's almost hard to say what influence is. It's just, it's, you know, expressivity itself is seems to me to be described by his voice.
And The Godfather of Soul, you did this big article, at times hilarious article in 2005 for Rolling Stone, where you're hanging out with James Brown and the band. By this point, you're already a pretty well-known writer. He has no idea, clearly, who you are, refers to you as Mr. Rolling Stone.
Mr. Rolling Stone. Yeah.
I mean, what kind of experience was that?
Well, it was an amazing immersion. I mean, it was really lucky circumstance. I was invited into the studio for what ended up being his last recording sessions.
Mm-hmm.
And I went down to Augusta and lived with the band in a Radisson, in a hotel. For 4 days and went every day with them to either play or not play. They spent a lot of time not playing at his whim. They sat, you know, idly ready with their instruments, you know, all tuned up. And I basically fell into the orbit of James Brown for a few days there. And it really is an orbit around a kind of bizarre planet. He's not like other people. Or, you know, I don't know when he last was, but he certainly wasn't anymore at this point. And his band, they're very, you know, they find him amusing and they find him terrifying and they find him, they're all entranced, they're all fans.
Mm-hmm.
They're also all slaves in a oppressive system, essentially. He abuses them and underpays them and under attributes their work and so forth. And I became one of them for this little period. It was like I just couldn't, it was like going to a nunnery and you suddenly realize, well, wait a minute. God is real. And so you become a nun for those 4 days. I just, you know, I had all the same ambivalences and intensity of, you know, When he glanced in my direction, my heart would sing, and I'd think, it's my time now. He's gonna, you know, he's gonna take care of me and give me some of his essence, and you know, and he was immensely comic, immensely tragic. It was just this great journey that I got to take.
Now, this is ostensibly a work of nonfiction. I mean, you're not making this stuff up.
No,
nonfiction and objectivity. You know, that kind of how much did you worry about kind of a journalistic responsibility to be objective?
Oh, I'm not too worried about it myself. I tend to like best the nonfiction, the essays or the reportage that dares to blur the line a little bit. Mm-hmm. You know, Bruce Chatwin as a travel writer, or you know, or Vivian Gornick's essays, or her memoir. Those kinds of examples, and there are many, many others. And of course, if you look into the past, you find that no one was as hidebound by the idea of being scrupulously objective as we are lately. Hmm. I think this is an inheritance from newspaper journalism, from daily journalism, from the kind of obsession with fact-based scrupulousness that comes with reporting on politics or other matters of public interest, but in my realm, in my range, let's say, of artists writing about artists and memoirists writing about themselves, I think that I bring all sorts of tools out of my fictional, toolkit.
We're speaking with the writer Jonathan Lethem, author of Chronic City, The Fortress of Solitude, Motherless Brooklyn, etc. His latest essay collection is called The Ecstasy of Influence. It is subtitled Nonfictions, Etc. I think your essay on the go-betweens would have to fall into the etc.
I wrote about my own projections. Yeah. I mean, this is actually – there's a tradition for doing this, you know, for the – and it's sort of indulgent one, which is you take an assignment and then you write about your ambivalence about taking the assignment, right? And I mean, you see this. David Foster Wallace does this with the famous essays. You know, okay, I'll write about lobsters for you, but I'll really just spend the entire time saying why it's really a queasy experience for me. And
the philosophy of lobstering. Yeah.
And Lester Bangs does this as well. I'll go write about Lou Reed, but I'll really tell you about how tormenting it is for me to have to talk to Lou Reed again. I love the go-betweens. They were very personal for me, but when I was asked to write about them, it became an emblem for me of my resistance to crossing the fan threshold into claiming some expertise or sort of, you know, sullying this love with my own professional activities. Mm-hmm. So I basically wrote a piece that said, no, I will not write about the go-betweens for you, and here's why.
And along the way, you make up this kind of imaginary history.
Completely wrong.
Fairly sordid.
And sordid, yes. And I've never been called to account by, you know, I've even gotten to know one of the go-betweens, but I've never broached the subject of whether they were troubled by my projections.
Jonathan Lethem writes about this Australian band, the Go-Betweens, in his essay called Open Letter to Stacy.
I recall a schoolboy coming home through fields of cane to a house of tin and timber, and in the sky a rain of falling cinders. From time to time the waste, memory waste.
The Australian band The Go-Betweens was essentially the songwriting partnership of Robert Forster and Grant McLennan, although their drummer figures prominently in Jonathan Lethem's unusual essay called Open Letter to Stacy, his sort of reminiscence, very personal take on an assignment to write about The Go-Betweens. Grant McLennan passed away just a couple of years ago.
Yeah, that might have been the most disconcertingly personal loss I've ever experienced in the pop realm. You know, the kind of things that I often feel very distant from, the collective mourning that goes on for a Michael Jackson, or figures that I have strong feelings about and sometimes adore the work, but I don't find that I slip into taking them as though they – into me as though they were a family member.
Mm-hmm.
And the grieving often seems quite exaggerated to me. But Grant McLennan, his death shattered me. I just was not ready for someone like him to die the way he did, having just reformed the band and claimed his own work in a way that it meant more to me than I even wanted to allow. When he died, I was really blindsided.
The Go-Betweens actually, during their period of reunion before Grant McLennan's death, played here in our soundcheck studio. Really memorable set of performances. Was there something different about the Go-Betweens for you from all of the – I mean, certainly pop music has lost more than its share of people over the years.
Well, of course it's about my own life, and that's that zone of projection and subjectivity that I guess, you know, in a novel like The Fortress of Solitude, I've made my subject. I'm not a musicologist. I can't be an objective expert about music, if such a thing is possible. I write about the space between the music and the listener, the space between the musician and the fan, and, you know, and then also about what it feels like to try to close that space as a performer or as a writer about music. So I'm interested in the ambiguities that arise. And so accounting for why, for me, the Go-Betweens are not only, you know, I can advocate for their music. I think they're brilliant, but they became crucial. They became some sort of axiom of my own personal journey into understanding of my own emotional reality. That's an uncanny fact that art can do that for us. I like to think about it and write about it, and it's something that can never be completely discharged for me.
I wonder if what you just said there is the answer to what was going to be my final question to you, which is there a big idea that kind of ties together for you all of the disparate essays in this collection, The Ecstasy of Influence?
Well, that's probably about as close as I could get. It would serve. I mean, this is a book about the relationship between my life as a fan or a reader or a participant in culture at the humblest layer, just letting it seep into me and pour over me. You know, the way Dylan arrived in my life without any conscious controls,
mm-hmm.
because he was part of my parents' lives, and the peculiarity of becoming someone who's supposed to have mastered it. I transmit culture now. I write a novel. I teach a novel, or I mediate between you and James Brown by writing this piece for Rolling Stone, but yet the fan is still alive in that experience, and the two things are intermingled all through this book, again and again and again.
If you're just joining us, all this week on the show, we're welcoming you to the Soundcheck Writers Club, listening back to our conversations about music with novelists, poets, and more. We're also listening to some in-studio performances with literary connections. The indie pop band Ra Ra Riot visited us last fall with a new album called Beta Love. The title track was inspired by the science fiction writing of cyberpunk novelist William Gibson and futurist author Ray Kurzweil.
We, as a band, were sort of getting into that, but particularly Matt was getting into Kurzweil's writing, and I was getting really into Gibson's writing.
Mm-hmm. Now, are any of the – there are numerous synthesizers here.
No, we don't have a Kurzweil synthesizer.
You see, in addition to writing some great books, Ray Kurzweil also invented the Kurzweil synthesizer. Here's the song that Kurzweil and William Gibson inspired called Beta Love. It's Ra Ra Riot in the Soundcheck studio.
Golden light, don't know why. If I run to you, would you stay? I might be a prototype, but we're both real inside. Let's go.
yes, hope. I believe you can't tell me no, it's no dream. In this city of robot hearts, ours were made to be. You'll take me up this time. You'll take me up this time.
Tomorrow on the show, our Writers Club week continues with the authors Colin McCann and George Saunders talking a little about their latest books and a lot about the music they love. By the way, all of our Writers Club shows are archived on our website, soundcheck.org. You can listen to them on demand or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes. Soundcheck is a production of WNYC. Irene Trudell leads our engineering team with Paul Schneider, Bill O'Neill, and Jason Isaac. The show is produced by Greta Cohn and Katie Bishop with Alex Kappelman and our interns, Alex Martinez and Ian Petrarca. Our digital producer is Mike Katziff. Our executive producer is Joel Meyer. I'm John Schaefer. See you back here tomorrow at 9. This is Soundcheck.